Hi, Debbie. This is Eric. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Eric?
I'm great. I'm sorry. I was in traffic in downtown. I'm not used to getting around the city. I'm in the gallery right now, actually.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I have to tell you, I really, really like this movie. This is such a creative take on the actual theft, which I remember when it happened, because it did actually make national news back in 1990. And the fact that these pieces of art are still not recovered to this day, it just blows my mind. And the fact that the museum is still offering a $10 million reward for any information leading to the recovery. I don't think there's ever been a heist like this with no clues, no anything, for so many decades. So I was fascinated by the theft to begin with, but then to see your film and what you've created as to how the theft took place, I think is fantastic. And having the character of Marty, it is, without a doubt, one of Paul Guilfoyle's shining moments in his career in terms of performance. Just well done on every level, Eric.
Thank you so much, Debbie. Yeah, that was the two big things I wanted, was to give Paul a nice big runway to let it rip, because people don't give him that. You know,
right.
He's loved for small roles in big films because everybody knows how good he is and that he'll show up and do something special. But I just wanted to give him a nice runway to play with. And that was one of the first things that I thought of. We were going to make the film earlier, and it was in the middle of COVID, and we sat around my table, and it was me and Paul and my executive producer, Jen Eagleson, and these guys all worked with Al Pacino and all these amazing actors back in Boston for years, and it was a great troupe, and we sat around the table, and Paul said, yeah, we can't make this movie now because movies are made around kitchen tables like this. We're all wearing masks and spaced out. It's just not going to work. And so we waited a little bit until we could make this around my kitchen table, which is exactly what we did. I'm from Cambridge, and I know this the robbery really well. It's one of the two great myths of Boston, I think, growing up. It was the Whitey Bulger myth and the Gardner myth. And I just thought it was, yeah, and I grew up, when I was a kid, I used to go to the museum before it was robbed, and I would sit and read a book in the cloisters, and it's just this lovely, peaceful place. And yeah, it's a mystery that endures. There are no, like you said, there are no clues. There's never been an arrest made. There's been plenty of people who've been talked about, mm-hmm. but nothing's ever been proven. And the only thing I know is a fact, the only thing we can all agree on, is that there were really interesting characters around this story, and that's what I wanted to make a movie about. Like, just the characters that amused me and that interested me, and I wanted to see, that's what I wanted to put forward in the movie, rather than solving the crime necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's what I really love, are the characters that you give us, and particularly the character of Marty. Because Marty, he is intellectual, he's curious, he's well-read, he's knowledgeable. He's not your run-of-the-mill grifter that you might find in the grittier section of Boston or any other big city. He thinks things through, and he understands the value, not just of a painting or a statue or a samurai blade, but he understands the value of living in the moment, living life. And we really, and Paul really just goes with that and takes us on Marty's journey. And that is so wonderful to see, because it goes against type for a lot of the heist films, so to speak, that we've seen over the decades. I applaud you for focusing on the characters. And you do give us an interesting cast of characters, Eric. You've got Bob Ra, you've got Albert, you've got Danny, and in many respects, they're very disparate and different, but then ultimately, with the exception of Marty, they really all kind of fall into the grit of Boston of the day.
and the crazy humor and the crazy knowledge and wisdom is under all of that, and that's what I see every day in Boston, and that's the story of the city that I know, and I don't see a lot of that in the movies made about Boston. They mostly focus on the tough guy, selfie thing, and that's not very interesting to me because that's not what I see. I see a much richer bouquet and all these wonderful character actors that are in Boston. Because so many films are made in Boston, we have a great group of character actors that still are there. So some of the top people we brought in from outside, like Paul and like Taylor, and then we filled the rest with these wonderful people that are locals, and that was really fun. It also made it feel real for everybody. So it was a really the casting was really fun, and a director's job is really just to make the sandbox and then let the actors play in the sandbox. And so we played around a lot. There was a lot of freedom, and that was my job, just to make sure that was the spirit of the movie, and then they took the rest.
Well, and something else that you also do here is you make Boston a character. Boston is a character in this film. You would not see this same group of people if you move them into any other city. Boston is very much a character around which everything else revolves, essentially. And I love that. Yeah. And we see things in Boston that we don't traditionally see in a film.
That was a really specific idea that we had from the beginning, is that I wanted to show the Boston that we don't see. When people come in from out of town to shoot in Boston because there is a tax credit, which is great, but those are outsiders, and I don't recognize the Boston that they show. Boston that mostly from outsiders show are they do drone flyovers over Fenway Park and people walking around in Red Sox hats. I wanted to show the Boston and the people in Boston that I drive by every day, that I live with every day. And when you don't have a big budget, when you're an independent filmmaker, the way, and it's very hard to make a period piece.
Yeah.
Normally what you have to do is you get all the cars and you have to get all the, change all the, get rid of cell phones, and you have to really change your environment. And that's really expensive. And what we decided was to find places where you could put the camera down, turn it 365 degrees or 360 degrees if you want to just keep within that circle. And everywhere you look, it still kind of looks like 1990. So that's what we had to do, and it wound up showing the part of Boston that is still there, that hasn't been developed, that is still where it was in 1990. And that's the Boston I love and that I grew up in and that I know, and that made it a lot cheaper to make this movie.
Mm-hmm. One thing that doesn't look cheap at all is your lighting and your lensing. And, Eric, you brought in one of my favorite cinematographers. What Am I did for my friend Jonathan Jakubowicz on Hands of Stone and Resistance. I have been in love with his work ever since. And this is so beautifully shot with lighting, with texture that is tactile. The contrast that we have from the grit outside of moving that camera 360 to the museum itself inside. And honing in and giving us unique angles, showcasing artworks that are now missing. Talk to me about developing your visual grammar, working with MI on this one, because it really is beautiful and plays to the city and to the story.
Yeah, I got very lucky. I mean, Miguel is like a soulmate. We just like kind of, I hit it off immediately with him, and we have very similar sensibilities. And I know that with Miguel, there's a lot that, he's from Chile.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the way he speaks, in the way he talked to me, he'll say, no, don't, I don't want to explain it. Just let me show you. You look and tell me if you like it. So he expresses the way he talks with the camera. He talks visually. That's much more preferred. He's quiet. He listens a lot, and then he shows you. And whatever Miguel points at looks amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I was just blown away by him. And what we decided, and what I've always thought from the beginning, is I don't like middle shots. I don't like shots that are like for TV. middle. I
right.
like real close-ups, and I like faraway shots, and I like mixing those up, and I like taking chances. Again, this is, as an indie filmmaker, our spirit was always, we're going to solve problems creatively rather than with money. So we didn't do a lot of takes. We made bold choices, and we cut in the camera, which means we knew what we wanted in advance. So we would have a plan, and we worked it around my kitchen table for a week, and we charted out everything that we were going to do with the camera, how the camera is going to express the scene, and it's going to express the characters. We mapped it all out so that when we showed up on set, Miguel and I had this map, and the first thing we would say to each other is, all right, how are we going to do it different?
Mm-hmm.
What are we going to do today? What do we feel like doing differently today? How can we change it? And we would say, let's do French cinema today. And we would play around with the camera like the French did in the New Wave. And then the next day it would be something completely different, more Coen Brothers. Oh, and that's how we would talk to each other. We said, oh, Coen Brothers? Yeah, okay, let's do Coen Brothers. And that's a wider angle on a close-up. And we use it for humor, and we use it, so it was really like playing with him. I found someone that I want to just make all my movies with from now on, which is great.
No, I mean, it looks beautiful, and particularly moving is going through when Marty is showing Steve the Rembrandt in the museum and going around and then talking about the samurai blade and the way he holds it. Really outstanding camera work that brings the audience into that appreciation for that art. And I was just so thrilled to see that unfold. And similarly, where you're talking about the wide shot, close-ups on a wide, look at some of the shots in the bar. Look at the courtroom. That is an amazing shot in the courtroom with Marty and Steve at the quote-unquote council table. That, I just fell in love with that shot. And then the judge up, up high with a perfect Dutch. Really, really visually exciting. That kind of goes with the whole idea of art, too. It's very metaphoric for art itself.
That's the idea, is that I didn't want to tell a story about the facts of what happened. I'm less interested in that. I'm more interested in the art that springs from it. And, that's exactly right. I watch a lot of movies with no sound on.
Mm-hmm.
To see, can this story be told?
Yes.
Visually, can I understand what's going on without any of the dialogue? That was a big leap when I moved from being a writer to a director. That,
mm-hmm.
that was the biggest leap of all, is, it can look sound and the dialogue can be really fun and great on paper, but that's not the job of the director. That you have to fire the writer at some point and just take over telling the story visually and letting the actors bring the rest to life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, I'm curious, did you actually shoot within the Gardner Museum itself, or did you have to build a museum set?
Everybody from Boston, everybody who knows the Gardner Museum, they all ask me, how did you get to shoot in the Gardner? That's what everybody asks them. You actually can't shoot in museums. It's so expensive, at least not an indie film, because the price of the insurance and the guards and everything. And we didn't build any sets. We couldn't afford that either. So we did exactly what you and I just talked about, that we went to a place, but what looks like it enough that we can pull it off. And there's a place north shore of Boston. There's a place called the Hammond Castle. And there's someone who was a contemporary of Isabel Stewart Gardner and admired her museum so much that he built his home similar to the design of the Gardner. So it looks like the Gardner, but it ain't the Gardner.
Wow. Now, what did you do to create these masterpieces? Because obviously they're missing, especially the one Rembrandt is so critical and so key to Marty's personality and who Marty is. So I'm curious, did you have a painter who could paint all of these missing pieces for you that you used?
I am sitting in a gallery right now in Chelsea. And in this gallery, It's only open for 3 days, but in this gallery are the 13 stolen pieces of art, and people are coming and looking at it, and they're lit perfectly. If you could see me now, you would see the Storm in the Sea of Galilee behind me, and then there's a another Rembrandt. All the pieces are here, and they have been, according to this gallery and the people that work here, they are the real thing. Donated by an anonymous donor, and people have been coming by and looking and asking a lot of questions. But we have somebody who can reproduce really, really well, taking, I don't want to reveal his techniques, but he has some incredible techniques to make it look really good. Everybody in this gallery is fooled.
Wow. Because you and I both know these are not the originals. We know this. Nobody in
the originals are gone.
They are long gone. It would be a thrill if they would reappear one day, but I don't know.
I don't know either.
Another part of the masterwork that you have, magic that you have performed here, Eric, is your editing, working with Marion. I loved her work on Clouds of Sils Maria and Personal Shopper. So I'm curious about your work with her and finding the pace here, because you do have some tension, you do have humor, and you maintain a pace, but there's also, you know, the issues of the theft itself and the harder, you know, when Bob Ross gets brought in here at one point, when you've got Kevin McDonald. So you have some shady things happening where you really need some tension, some fear. So how challenging was the edit and the joy of working with Marion on this one?
Because this is my first directorial film, my first rodeo, I didn't really know what the next step in front of me was. So when we finished shooting, I said, okay, so what do we do now? And they said, well, we've got to edit the film, and we need an editor. I said, well, okay, so how do we find an editor? And they said, my producer said, well, watch a lot of films that you like, and we can use that as a template for editors, find an editor. And so my favorite director is Olivier Assayas, and I watched both films that you just mentioned, and I know those films really well.
Yeah.
I loved them. And he had just done also Irma Vep for HBO, which was a remake of it's a TV remake of his film from the 1990s, and it had a humor to it, and it had a fluidity, and I watched it, and I couldn't find the cuts. Like, she's cutting in places that you don't even know. I had to go back and find, go in reverse and see where she cut, and she did it with such a light touch, and there was so much humor without it being silly. I just loved everything about it, and I said, okay, well, someone like Marion, and then I said, well, wait a minute, what if I tried to find her, and I called everybody I knew in L.A., my manager, and all my friends in L.A. from my whole writing career, and we couldn't, she had no information on IMDb Pro, there was no contact information, but I had a friend who worked at on something at HBO, and he wound up calling an editing house in Paris that worked on Irma Vep, and they got me her number, and I called her, and I said, hey, I have a crazy idea. I know this is, you've never done a film, an American film before, and you don't know me, but I made a film about Boston, a very local film about Boston, but I was really inspired by this French film called Shoot the Piano Player by Truffaut, and the way he took a genre, and which his was a crime genre, and he put that in the background, and what he focused on was the characters, and that's what he was interested in, and he kept the genre underneath it, but how little of the genre can you tell, and tell the stuff that was more interesting to you? That's what I set out to do, and she said, I have a crazier idea, I will come and edit it. So she came to Cambridge, and she did some editing there, and then I went to Paris, and we finished it up over there, and again, there are some, she will cut in the middle of a pan shot, and you won't even know, and nobody does that. Mm-hmm. And she just creates this lovely fluidity and, this gentle touch, and she just has so many good ideas, and I just love working with her also, and also I feel like I found somebody, need to, because she's very busy, I need to mark her time, her calendar, and say, all right, I can you reserve May of 2026 for me, because I have another movie I'm working on.
Another new learning curve for you, in addition to editing, you know, hey, we got the stuff in the can, what comes next, is this music, the score. So I'm curious, you know, what you were looking for musically to serve as your undercurrent to this wonderful creative story and these great performances.
I love these questions because these are my favorite stories. I did the exact same thing with music. I was done editing and I said, okay, how do I get music? And they said, well, you need a music supervisor. So, well, how do I do that? They said, well, just what movies do you look at soundtracks to movies and what do you like? And it turned out that the same person who is the GOAT, the greatest of all time music supervisor, is Karen Rackman. It turns out that she did the, she was a music supervisor for all the soundtracks that I know. So she worked with Tarantino on Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs, and she did Boogie Nights with P.T. Anderson, and she did, I think it was Reality Bites, all in Laurel Canyon, all of these incredible soundtracks. These are the only soundtracks that I remember. And mm-hmm. Again, I was thinking about her as a template, but then I said, you know what, I'm going to call her. And I found her, and I called her, and I said, here's the story. I made a movie about 1990 in Boston, and I want to tell the musical story of what was going on at that time, which was a very particular movement. It's called Loud, Soft, Loud, really, that wound up influencing the next generation. So these were bands like the Pixies and the Breeders and, you know, Jonathan Richman, who was a little earlier, but still this sort of Boston music at that very particular moment really, you know, influenced the grunge movement, and it influenced, you know, Nirvana. You know, Kurt Cobain said there is no Nirvana without the Pixies. Mm-hmm. And that all came from Boston, and it was all happening in 1990. And I said that to Karen, and she said, yeah, okay, I know why you called. Yeah, all right, I'll do it. So I got Karen, and Karen and Otis Rackman together, they're amazing. They got us all this incredible music, and they got me to our composer, which is Lou Barlow, who lives in Massachusetts, who is in a band called Dinosaur Jr. and Sebado, and he scored only one other film before called Kids by Larry Clark. He did the music for that, and he was in Laurel Canyon. He plays the music there, too, and he's excellent, and he was just also from that era. So we took some of his songs from some of his different bands, and we wove them into the movie.
I love the score, and I love your needle drops. And it goes with the energy and the grit of the area and of the crime. And it's a lot of fun. So now, here we are. Everybody's going to get to see this film now. They're going to see it. They're going to see any day now. So as you look back on this experience, what did you learn about yourself as a filmmaker, especially a first-time director, that you can now take forward into your future projects?
You know, I've been a writer for 25 years, so I wrote a bunch of Hollywood movies and many, many films. There are hundreds of minutes of stuff that I worked on that I can see on the screen, and out of all of that time, about a minute and a half of it feels like me. Mm-hmm. And that's why I did this, because the last film that I wrote, it just changed the tone of it. It was completely different from what I intended, and that's why I went into this. How can I make a smaller film? How can I make a film, though, that feels bigger? How can I make a film that has my voice? And it feels like, even though all these terrific people have worked on it and have brought their selves to it, I feel like, for the first time, oh, this feels like me. It's so strange, but I guess there's a mix of all of our intentions together, but it's a confidence in my own voice that I've never had, you know, and I'm constantly pushing myself to not be scared. You know, that from the first day on the set even talking about music, the temptation is, oh, let's flood the scene. You know, a lot of people put a lot of music over a lot of scenes.
Yeah.
Because they don't have the confidence that the scene can hold itself. And to be able to, we slowly brought up the music. In the first half of the movie, there is not a lot, and it sort of grows. But the confidence to say, we tried a little music, and I said, no, you know what? Let's leave it off. Let's leave it the way it is. Let's let the actors do their thing. We don't need to underscore what their feelings are. And that comes from a lack of self-confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, or, you know, I have to do certain things. It needs to be graphic to grab people. You're thinking outward what other people would want. And it's important. I do have an eye. I'm not just doing this for myself, but it's the ability to kind of trust myself. I think that's the biggest thing I've learned out of this. And so whatever I do next, to just remember that it's the singer, not the song. So
mm-hmm.
whatever comes across my desk, can I make it something that feels more me? And that is really my job. And that, and also getting out of the, hiring great people and getting out of their way. Those are the things that I learned the most.
Now that you have directed a film, do you think it will impact your writing in the future, giving you a directorial eye as you're putting pen to paper or fingers to the keyboard?
It already has, absolutely, because I used to write scripts that were loved, that actors loved them, which is what helped me in my career quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I was on the blacklist with a movie. I've worked with Johnny Depp for many years. I worked with Sacha Baron Cohen. I've had movies at Warner's. The scripts on paper were really funny, and they flowed, and they read really well. And then I was just so curious why, when they were changed so much with a different tone once they became films. And I think what I realized is that I wasn't putting into the script the material that a director really needs to make a scene. And they looked great, and they were funny, and I have an ear for dialogue. Like, sort of, those are my assets.
Mm-hmm.
But I realized my liabilities. I realized what I wasn't doing, which was doing the basic building blocks of a scene. They have to be there for a director to be able to go to work, which is maybe why all my scripts were changed so much, because they read really well. Actors loved doing them, but they didn't quite have the building blocks underneath them.
Mm-hmm.
That you needed. So that's the big change for me. I have a different eye towards what makes a scene and how important dialogue is, or how unimportant in some ways dialogue is, and how important, more important, are the movements of these characters and how they move closer or further apart from each other.
You have totally impressed me, Eric. I personally cannot wait to see what you do next. I want to see the next film that you do and how you put all of this newly learned information and skill set, how you infuse it into the next project, because this one, it belies it being your first directorial. It is far superior to, I'd say, probably 80% of the first directorials that I have seen over the past 43 years. Job so well done. I wouldn't even mind a sequel where suddenly the paintings show up somewhere. And we get another backstory.
Yeah, for the past 6 months, I've been putting my similar energies into the effort that it takes to get a movie out into the world. And I just directed four commercials about the ghosts of the gardener.
Ooh.
And that they get together at night and they talk about the painting. So I'm not done. I think in the selling of a movie also, or getting a movie out to public, you get to tell the story again in a different, new way, which is why I've opened this gallery,
mm-hmm.
and which is why I'm pushing out these new ads, and we're trying our own method of getting the film to market, which is different, I think, probably than anybody's done. I teamed up with the Madison Avenue kind of advertising team, and we've created like a really multi-phase campaign to get this out into the world. And on the 21st of March, we're going to release the movie in a limited way in New York and Boston at a couple theaters, and online at the same time. and we're going to leave it out, and then we're going to pull it back just to dip our toe in the water and see if we can push some of our marketing and see what kind of response we get, and then we'll adjust the plan and move to a larger release closer to May. But we're going to release it a little bit and see what kind of response we get.
Oh my God, I can't wait for that. You need to release it somewhere in Los Angeles so I can see it. But it will be online, so I could see it online for that limited time frame.
We're going to this Kinema site. I'll send it to you, but there's a place that kind of is hosting our movie for a week, and you can see that everywhere. And then the plan is, then we're going to try some theaters next, and then maybe we'll try online. It's just such a different world now.
Yeah.
There's no straight path anymore, so I'm kind of excited because I have the opportunity to experiment because I control it. That's the other big difference between this and the Hollywood films. Like, I saved up for all these years to do this, and I've been waiting a long time for this, and I'm in a position which I've never been in before where I'm controlling also how it's going to come to market. I don't have to answer to anyone. That's like
yeah, that's the fun part. You don't have to answer to anyone. Yeah. So, and it will be totally your vision from start to finish.
Yeah. I live and die on my terms.
Yeah.
I like that.
I think that's a fantastic way to be. You kind of a lot like Marty.
Yes. That's right. There's just many ways to tell the story. This is an alternative way to tell the story. We're not running the festival circuits with our hands out, hoping that a company buys us up. We're going to disrupt, and we'll go into the market, and we're going to do it and see what happens.
I cannot wait, Eric. I'm excited to see whatever you put out there, because I thoroughly enjoyed this. You have demonstrated your abilities as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, and I love the film. I think other people will too. I love that Paul is showcased. He finally gets to break out as a leading actor. Job so well done.
Thank you so much, Debbie. Keep up next time I'm out in LA.
Definitely.
I'll try to get the movie in a theater near you.
Definitely. I would love that. Because I always prefer to see things on the big screen anyway.
Me too, but we can't change people's behavior.
No.
That's the other thing I learned.
Sadly, we cannot. But we can keep trying.
We can make it available. We can make it available to people who want to see it in different ways.
Yes.
That I'm interested in.
Yes, very much so. Well, you go have a wonderful weekend, and hopefully we will chat sooner rather than later in the future.
I'm excited and looking forward to it. Thank you so much for the amazing questions, Debbie.
Oh, thank you, Eric. And we'll talk soon.
All right, take care.
You too. Bye-bye.